President Biden sat down with President Putin today. Both sides set the bar pretty low by design.
They have absolutely zero expectations. That's the lesson that they've learned.
We'll wrap up their meeting on the show. Also today, violent spikes in Israel and Gaza. Hamas is sending incendiary helium balloons across the border.
What it is basically a Molotov cocktail with wings. And the very high-tech Israeli army has not found any solutions.
Except to respond with more airstrikes. And among the people trying to cross into the U.S. from Mexico, Roma from Romania, escaping racism in Europe.
Can kind of live free from kind of day-to-day racism in places like the United States as a Romani person.
I'm Marco Werman. All of that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Thanks for being with us today. President Biden met face-to-face with the world leader he's described as a killer, someone with no soul, and a worthy adversary. That's what Biden called Russian President Vladimir Putin earlier this week. Biden, as I said, has also called Putin a killer, to which Putin responded, "It takes one to know one." But despite the tension in the lead-up to the summit, the two leaders were overly cordial in their remarks following their meeting in Geneva today. Speaking through an interpreter, Putin stressed there was no hostility between the two men.
This was a productive meeting. It was fruitful, it was to the point, and it took place in an atmosphere that was actually enabling.
In fact, during his press conference, the two did not share the stage together, Putin repeatedly mentioned how the U.S. and Russia face the same threats, from cyber attacks to climate change. Neither side made any threats, Biden said, and while they have their clear differences, the two leaders lay the groundwork for future cooperation.
This is not a kumbaya moment, as you used to say back in the 60s in the United States, like, let's hug and love each other. But it's clearly not in anybody's interest, your country's or mine, for us to be in a situation where we're in a new Cold War.
For more insight into the meeting between the two presidents, we're joined now by Rose Gottemuller. She was also the lead U.S. negotiator for the new START arms reduction treaty, and she was on the team that briefed President Biden for his meeting with Putin. Welcome to the program.
Glad to be here, Marco.
So you heard the two press conferences, Rose, that both men gave. Did both leaders get what they came for?
It sounds like it, frankly, although, you know, the stance of the two was so different. You know, Putin was definitely being the master propagandist that he is and throwing everything back at the United States. Everything wrong in Russia was the fault of the United States. And frankly, you know, I'm used to that. His Soviet predecessors did the same. But that was not the kind of thing we were hearing from Biden. What I liked about Biden was the way in which he subtly, you know, he didn't issue any threats, just as you said a moment ago, but he subtly indicated that there are some things that Putin ought to think about. He said, I just made some simple assertions, such as, does he really want a Cold War with us when he's facing a 1,200-mile border with China, and China is surging economically and militarily? Now, of course, Putin would never admit that he's concerned about China or Xi Jinping, but, you know, maybe that got him thinking. So, in other words, I thought there was a certain subtlety in Biden's approach, certainly as conveyed during his press conference, compared to what we were hearing from Mr. Putin.
I'm curious, what advice did you give President Biden? Did you see any of your advice come into play today?
Well, I don't want to, as they say, in any way endanger the confidentiality of those exchanges. But I will say that Biden seemed to me, even going into that meeting, very well prepared. He'd known about Putin's behavior for a long time. He'd met with him in the Kremlin when he was vice president. And furthermore, his negotiating skills were well honed in all his years in the Senate. So I think he was well prepared for the meeting. But it was good, as far as I was concerned. He was very interested in the strategic stability agenda. And so I talked to him about that. And it was very good that, to me, it was front and center again in the remarks that both Putin and Biden made about what had transpired.
There are so many disagreements and areas of confrontation between Russia and the U.S. Did Biden make any headway on human rights, for example, the case of Russian political prisoner Alexei Navalny?
Not seemingly. I mean, again, all the remarks of Putin were not taking any blame whatsoever for human rights violations in the Russian Federation or in any way indicating he was ready to make anything right. But I liked the way Biden put it. He said, you really have to just understand that what I was trying to do was get across three things. I identify our practical work areas, remark directly, comment directly on issues that are important to us and make very clear are the priorities and values of the United States. And those last two really get to the issues of human rights and Alexei Navalny. And I think he left Putin in no uncertain terms as to what U.S. views are of the Navalny case and the remarks about, well, what would happen if Navalny died in jail? You need to think about that, President Putin, if you want your country to be in any way able to work with the rest of the world.
Another area of confrontation is cybersecurity. The U.S. alleges that Russia was behind several ransomware attacks on the U.S. From what you heard today, Rose, is this an area where the U.S. and Russia can make progress?
I hope so. The fact that they are going to really get down to substantive discussions. We have had working groups working on issues like cyber confidence building and so forth for many years. So the two communities, the technical communities, know each other in the United States and Russia. I do think there's a potential to make progress here. Evidently, according to Biden, we handed over a list of our particular no-go zones where we would like to see a kind of sanctuary established for not attacking with cyber weapons in both countries. And I think that, that's important. It has to do with protecting critical infrastructure, which again is something that Putin should be concerned about in the Russian Federation. So I think we've got the technical wherewithal. We've got the right people. Now, can we make progress on the specifics? And both men seem to indicate it was a high priority. They wanted to see progress in this area.
Just a few seconds left. From what we've seen today, Rose, is President Putin a leader that Biden and the U.S. can actually work with?
I think that it will be necessary to work with him on areas where we have a mutual interest. And again, I think that Biden has it right when he said it's not about trust, but it's about our self-interest, the U.S. self-interest. And he got that point across very squarely, I thought, in his press conference. I'm sure it's the same point that he made to Putin directly.
Rose Gottemuller, the lead U.S. negotiator for the new START Arms Reduction Treaty, thank you very much for being with us to unpack today's meeting in Geneva.
My pleasure, Marco.
For both presidents, Biden and Putin, today's summit is not their first rodeo. These are seasoned politicians with decades of international experience. In the foreground, however, is a fraught history of U.S.-Russian relations. The World's Daniel Offman reports on how we got here.
When Vladimir Putin rose to power in Russia, the U.S. actually had high hopes. After all, the U.S. believed that Russia was moving to embrace capitalism, freedom, and democracy. In 2001, President George W. Bush saw Putin as someone he could work with.
I looked the man in the eye. I found him to be very straightforward and trustworthy.
Bush met Putin in Slovenia exactly 20 years ago today.
We had a very good dialogue. I was able to get a sense of his soul. He's a man deeply committed to his country and the best interests of his country. And I appreciated so very much the frank dialogue.
About 4 months later came 9/11. Putin was the first foreign leader to call President Bush after the attacks. At the time, the U.S. and Russia were routinely sharing intelligence. That was seen as useful, says Simon Sarajan. He's the director of the Russia Matters Project at Harvard University.
I mean, who would have declined sharing of intelligence on Afghanistan?
And it wasn't just Afghanistan where Washington and Moscow saw mutual interests.
If you look at Putin's statements, they reflected a general desire to be cooperative with the U.S. He thought that there were interests that converged and that could help to reach some kind of an arrangement.
This was a high point in U.S.-Russia relations, but it didn't last. Over the next several years, Putin's view of the U.S. changed drastically. Anna Arutunyan is a Russia analyst with the Wilson Center's Kenan Institute.
He believes that the United States is out to make life difficult for Russia, to contain it, to make it weaker, possibly to destroy. This is the view of some Kremlin officials.
The proof of that was seen in the expansion of NATO into Eastern Europe. And second, Putin's perception that the U.S. was supporting so-called color revolutions on Russia's doorstep.
All of this cumulatively had the effect that Putin decided over time that they will never consider us equals. They will always want to talk down to us. They will always want to dominate. That's just the way the world works.
Что же такое однополярный мир? Как бы ни украшали этот термин.
In 2007, Putin expressed disdain for what he saw as Western expansion. He said that countries like the U.S. like to lecture Russia about democracy, while they themselves ignore democratic principles. The following year, Putin raised the ante. Here's Simon Sarajan again.
His sort of accumulation of grievances reached the point where they just erupted. And that point was during the August 2008 war with Georgia.
Now to the fighting between Russia and Georgia over the Georgian breakaway region of South Ossetia.
Georgia's president says Russia is attacking his country, dropping bombs and moving tanks into Georgian territory.
When Russia invaded and occupied large swaths of Georgia, Washington came out in support of Georgian sovereignty. The U.S. and Russia were entering dangerous territory. In January 2009, Barack Obama became president and tried to start over with Moscow. He sent Secretary of State Hillary Clinton to seek a reset in the relationship. She met with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov.
Let's do it together.
So we will do it together, okay?
During a joint appearance, Clinton handed Lavrov a small reset button with the word written in Russian as a symbolic gesture.
We worked hard to get the right Russian word. Do you think we got it?
You get it wrong.
I got it wrong.
It should be перезагрузка. And this says перегрузка, which means overcharged.
Despite the awkward start, Simon Sarajan says the two sides actually made progress.
And generated results, including New START, which is a very important treaty. In fact, it's the backbone of the nuclear arms control between Russia and U.S.
The New START treaty was an important accomplishment, but it didn't take long for the relationship to sour once more. In 2012, Putin took over again as Russia's president. Protesters said the election was fraudulent. Here's Anna Arutunyan again.
Putin became convinced that Hillary Clinton helped organize these protests, paid for them, inspired them, etc. So in the Kremlin's perception, this is what the Obama administration had done, that they interfered in Russia's political processes by supporting the opposition.
Then things got worse. In 2014, Russia annexed Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula and invaded eastern Ukraine. Obama's reset was officially over, and along came a new American president.
Wouldn't it be great if we actually got along with Russia? Am I wrong in saying that? Wouldn't it be great?
Donald Trump repeated this idea throughout his presidency, even after the U.S. intelligence community concluded that Russia tried to influence the outcome of the 2016 election. Trump even stood next to Putin during a news conference in Helsinki and questioned the credibility of his own government's intelligence agencies.
Some others, they said they think it's Russia. President Putin. He just said it's not Russia. I will say this. I don't see any reason why it would be. But
I think this is really where the calculus shifted, where for the first time in decades, the Kremlin actually had a legitimate reason to consider itself the adult in the room.
Two impeachments later, where Russia played a big role in the proceedings, and there's a new American president looking to turn the page. So what lessons is Joe Biden taking away from more than two decades of fraught U.S.-Russia relations? Here's Simon Sarajan.
I think Biden is the first president who has not attempted a rapprochement with Russia. And I think each of the previous presidents would try some version of a reset, thinking that, you know, I am the president, I know how to, in case of Trump, to make deals.
So for the Biden White House, the aim is to keep expectations low. And that's where President Putin and the Kremlin stand as well. Here's Anna Arutunyan.
They have absolutely zero expectations. That's the lesson that they've learned.
One advantage of starting at yet another low point for the U.S. and Russia means that any progress the two sides can make will now be seen as an achievement. For The World, I'm Daniel Offman.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. For many fans, competitive sports are an escape, a break for a few hours from real life. It's a sudden shock when real life intrudes, as it did this past weekend. A scary incident on the soccer pitch that has the sports world looking for answers. Here's The World, Sarah Birnbaum.
Christian Eriksen is lucky to be alive. On Saturday, in the middle of a European championship game, the Danish star was jogging up the field when he just keeled over and fell face forward.
The play is going to be halted again, and this does look serious.
Medics rushed onto the field to help. Eriksen's teammates formed a protective shield around him to block out the cameras. Denmark's team doctor later said Eriksen suffered a cardiac arrest. His heart simply stopped beating.
He was gone, and we did cardiac resuscitation. How close were we? I don't know. We got him back after one defib.
It wasn't the first time something like this has happened. Marc Vivien Foué from Cameroon died on the soccer pitch in 2003. Chick Tiote from Ivory Coast died in 2017 during practice. And Fabrice Muamba collapsed on the pitch in 2012. He only survived because a top cardiologist happened to be in the stands that day. Still, sudden cardiac arrest is rare, though athletes are at the greatest risk. Zaf Iqbal, the head of sports medicine for the Crystal Palace Football Club in the UK, likes to compare it to driving a car.
If you've got a car that can do 150 miles an hour, if you're driving that car at 80 miles an hour, the engine, everything about the car will be able to handle it. Whereas if you're driving the car at the maximum, 140, 150 miles an hour, you're more likely to get a problem with that car.
And he says it's the same with regards to the heart.
If you're stressing it to the maximum, and a lot of these athletes are, then you're more likely to get a problem.
There's also some evidence to suggest that the risk is even greater for those who play certain sports like basketball and soccer with a lot of starting and stopping. And in most cases, there's usually an underlying genetic condition or rare heart abnormality. But in Eriksen's case, doctors have no idea what happened. Sanjay Sharma is Eriksen's former cardiologist.
He was tested annually from 2012 all the way until very recently, and all his tests were normal. So is it that our tests missed something? There's a possibility. Or is it that he may have acquired something between his last test and the most recent cardiac arrest?
On Saturday, Christian Eriksen was eventually taken off the field in a stretcher while fans of both teams chanted his name in support. Eriksen is still in the hospital getting more tests, says Sanjay Sharma.
Well, the most important thing is to find out what actually caused this cardiac arrest. That's what's paramount.
Because until then, elite athletes all over the world are wondering, could this happen to them too? For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
While President Biden is abroad this week, he's sure to hear about Europe's own response to migration and how the EU has also tried to slow it down by injecting international aid to places those people are fleeing from, similar to how the U.S. is approaching migration from Central America. But has that worked? To hear more, we turn to Roberto Forin. He's in Geneva with the Mixed Migration Center, which studies migration globally. The center is also part of the Danish Refugee Council. So, Roberto, it's a big question, I know. What is the current EU approach towards stemming unauthorized migration to its member countries?
You mentioned part of it is using development aid for the purpose of trying to reduce irregular migration toward Europe. If we look at the result of that approach, it has, on the one hand, reduced the number of people coming to Europe. But on the other hand, we have seen in Africa an increase, massive increase of internally displaced people and the refugees. They don't have a choice. It has not been effective in addressing root causes.
Well, as you rightly point out, that will take long-term investment. Is the EU starting to think about this in a more comprehensive way?
Absolutely, absolutely. There is $90 billion to be invested in Africa. 10% of this $90 billion are going to be used for tackling migration. And then I think that this is a better approach, is more long-term, is more sustainable, and tackling also other aspects of international cooperation beyond migration.
I think of a country like Libya, which, you know, has been ruined since the post-Qaddafi years. People are leaving, but it's also a transit point for sub-Saharan Africans who want to get to Europe. How will EU aid specifically help Libya?
What Europe has done with Libya mostly is to ask them to keep people there at any cost, honestly. We all have heard the horrific situation in detention facility for migrants in Libya. So on top of that, this approach has incentivized a further destabilization of the country, because some of the money that was invested in Libya for this detention facility, they were going to armed group. So a different approach is needed. First, all effort need to be put in stabilizing the country, so in supporting peace in the country. And only after, when the situation is more stable, then Europe will have an interlocutor to discuss migration management.
What about the natural kind of annual pull for people to migrate to work in Europe? I mean, not just in crisis times. I mean, are there legal pathways opening up to recognize that kind of draw and labor demand in Europe?
Not so much. Speaking about legal pathways in Europe remain quite a toxic issue, because a certain part of the political spectrum is they are accused of letting people coming in and stealing jobs and stealing welfare. So it is true that it's complicated to speak about legal pathways. On the other hand, it is happening because Europe is in need of regular migrants. We know that demography is a bit in crisis in Europe as much as it is in US. There are jobs that are not fulfilled, and this means going through legal pathways. So on the one hand, it's not publicly discussed, especially when it comes to managing migration. On the other hand, it's happening as we speak, because we need more migrants. And now we know that the next step is going to be to find ways to attract workforce from abroad. We might switch from a situation where discussing legal pathways is toxic to a situation in 10 years from now where we'll be competing against each other to attract migrants to our economic system.
Roberto Forin speaking with us from Geneva. He's with the Mixed Migration Center, which studies global migration and is also part of the Danish Refugee Council. Roberto, thank you for being with us.
Thank you very much.
After weeks of waiting, there may be a new president in Peru. He's won the most votes in Peru's contentious elections, but Pedro Castillo still can't be declared the winner. You can read more about the election in Peru in our newsletter. Sign up at theworld.org/newsletter. And coming up later in the show, the Netherlands had a long involvement with slavery. Now a national museum in Holland is shining a light on that troubling history.
There are much more attempts to present a human face to enslaved people.
Meanwhile, loud debates continue about what history should be told. We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. For some people who get COVID, the infection is just the beginning. Cognitive and physical conditions can linger. This woman was infected a year ago.
I used to cycle 13 miles a day on my commute to work, and then I've been having to use a wheelchair for more than a year because I actually couldn't walk 5 meters sometimes.
What researchers are learning about long COVID, that's coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Among the thousands of undocumented migrants and asylum seekers crossing the U.S.-Mexico border in recent weeks have been dozens of Roma people from Romania. U.S. Customs and Border Protection says the number of Roma detained at the southern border is at its highest level since 2007. So why are Roma migrants making the journey all the way to Mexico, then to the U.S. border? The World's Europe correspondent Orla Barry has our story.
When Christiana Grigori heard that scores of Roma are travelling thousands of miles from Eastern Europe to the US-Mexico border, she wasn't surprised.
That shows just the extent of how hard their lives is and the discrimination they face. And I mean, it's really in Europe, saying you're Roma is almost like saying you're a criminal. It's the greatest stigma you can possibly face.
Grigori knows all about that stigma. She's Roma herself, born in southern Romania. Today, she's speaking to me from New York. And for her entire childhood, she kept her ethnic origins a secret, particularly at school.
My mom has fair skin, and that allowed me to pass. My dad has darker skin, but he never came to school to pick me up or to any meetings because he didn't want to bring any suspicions that we're Roma.
Grigori remembers one day when a boy in her class suggested she was Roma.
He had his suspicions that I'm Roma because my skin is darker than the average Romanian. And he asked one of our professors, and the professor said, I'm not Roma, although that particular professor never asked me, but she said that I'm not Roma to protect me.
Grigori says she pretended not to know what the boy was talking about. The Roma population is spread out across Europe, but Romania has one of the largest Roma communities, where they make up over 8% of the country's population. Jonathan Lee is with the European Roma Rights Centre. He says Romania is one of the worst countries in Europe to be Roma.
We're talking about completely segregated villages, often with no access to public supply water or electricity. I think the infant mortality rate is like 3 times higher than the rest of the population. And then on top of that, you have rampant discrimination from society, as well as this institutional racism from every single public authority. It's hard to describe how badly Roma are failed at every level by the state in Romania.
The number of Roma making the journey to the US from Europe is still small, particularly in comparison to those travelling from Central and South America. A little over 2,000 Roma have been detained by US border officials since the start of the year. In the month of May alone, Customs and Border Protection says it expelled migrants back across the border to Mexico 110,000 times. Lee says the United States appeals to many Roma in Europe because it's seen as a less racist place.
You can kind of pass under the radar a little bit more than you can in somewhere like Romania, which is really like a bi-ethnic state. You really stand out in most Eastern European countries in this way, and you can kind of live free from kind of day-to-day racism in places like the United States as a Romani person compared to what you would at home.
But the chances of being granted asylum in the US for Roma people are still small. Dana Buchin is originally from Romania. Today she works as an immigration attorney in Connecticut. Buchin has represented Roma families from Romania seeking asylum in the US. She says just describing the level of racism in her home country against Roma people isn't enough.
Yes, you are discriminated in Romania in general, but have there been any instances of discrimination against you and your family in particular? I could give you an example of what I did for a successful case. There was a case in which the person was beaten and ended up in the hospital. And there were hospital records to prove that the person was treated for severe beatings.
One of Buchan's main tasks now is trying to reunite Roma children with their parents after they were forcibly separated at the US-Mexico border under the Trump administration's so-called zero-tolerance policy.
Apparently, there are 25 to 30 kids, mostly of Roma origin, Romanian citizens, who are in the United States without parents and have been without parents all this time, basically since 2018, when the zero-tolerance policy went into effect.
Buchan says she understands the children are in foster care, but no one knows where their parents are. For those Roma who are granted asylum, Buchan says many try to hide their ethnic identity once they settle in the States. Christiana Grigore understands the sentiment all too well. When she first arrived in the US on a student exchange at the age of 22, she kept her ethnic origin a secret. But one day, an incident with a friend brought things to a head.
One of my close friends couldn't find a significant amount of money. And although he never accused me, I remember asking him to look in my bag, and basically he found the money. He just misplaced them in his office. And I remember sobbing and sobbing even more after he found the money. And my behavior was so strange. And why would you feel accused if nobody accused you? Well, because of all these internalized images and stereotypes about what Roma are like seen as.
It was after this that Grigori says she started to explore how she could embrace her cultural identity. Today, she runs the Roma Peoples Project at Columbia University. It aims to inform Americans about the history of Roma culture and to tackle the negative stereotypes that still exist. Grigori has a one-year-old son. He's half Roma, she tells me, and I don't want him to feel he has to hide who he really is. For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
For many people, contracting COVID-19 is just the beginning. After the initial infection has passed, there's a range of conditions that can show up. These post-COVID or long COVID conditions, as they're known, appear to be rare but are becoming increasingly common as caseloads grow. They're also getting more attention thanks to patients like Claire Hasty.
I've actually been feeling much better the last month or so. Touch wood.
Claire Hasty is the founder of Long COVID Support, a group that has tens of thousands of members around the world. It started last year as a Facebook group. Claire joins us now from Birmingham, England. I wonder if you could start by telling us about your own experience, Claire, with COVID. What exactly happened?
Yeah, so I fell ill on the 17th of March 2020, and my children fell ill not long after with what we believe to be COVID, although we never had any positive tests because they weren't available at the time. Over the months, probably had 30 or 40 different symptoms affecting my heart. I had a feeling like an elephant was sitting on my chest. I had shortness of breath, neurological symptoms with pins and needles and numbness. And I had mobility issues whereby my muscles felt like I'd been kind of cycling up a big hill. I used to cycle 13 miles a day on my commute to work. Mm. And then I've been having to use a wheelchair for more than a year because I actually couldn't walk 5 meters sometimes.
I'm so sorry.
So yeah, you name it. Unable to walk and work for more than a year, but starting, I hope, to feel a little bit better in the last month or so.
Very good to hear that. How did your group Long COVID Support actually come together, and what are you working on?
Yeah, so my friend sent me an article 2nd of May last year that explained that other people had also failed to recover. I was so ill, I hadn't even quite questioned why am I not getting better when the government tells me I'll be fine in a couple of weeks. Mm. But when I saw this article, it brought tears to my eyes. I was like, oh my gosh, I'm not the only one going through this. And I'd had some information shared with me by a school friend of my sister's who's a physio specializing in ME and chronic fatigue syndrome. And I'd written to her saying, have you got any tips? Because I'm so paranoid about getting a post-viral condition. And so she sent me some tips. So I set up a Facebook group to share information and for peer support. And we've now got over 41,000 members in 100 countries. And the group has, with peer support at its heart, it's developed soon into advocacy and campaigning for rehab, research and recognition, a three-word slogan that we came up with last summer to try and raise awareness because we were invisible. And around the world, people were invisible. And it's because of the patient voices, actually, that you know we've been told by people at the WHO and people within the UK government, and I know it's the same in the US, it's patient advocacy has been what's really made a big difference in pushing for help with people.
I mean, there are clearly a lot of overlying issues around long COVID. You said the sense of feeling invisible. I mean, the CDC this week just defined post-COVID conditions as an umbrella term for a wide range of physical and mental consequences of the disease. The WHO is also trying to come up with a clinical definition of this phenomenon. How do you define post-COVID or long COVID, and how important is it that it gets named?
Oh my gosh, it's such a minefield actually, because the symptoms can affect any part of the body. There's so much overlap with other conditions. So people talk about ME and chronic fatigue syndrome, that's an area of overlap. People talk about multiple sclerosis, there are symptoms in common with that, with autoimmune conditions like lupus or Lyme disease, even with menopause, for example. So how you define this, I honestly don't know.
Do we even know what's causing post-COVID symptoms? I mean, where is the research at?
So, I mean, based on some of the findings discussed at the WHO seminar this week, the working hypotheses are it could be all or any of a combination of viral persistence. So the virus is kind of lurking in sort of reservoirs, maybe in your gut or different parts of the body that can be kind of reactivated or keeping the immune system triggered. There's also evidence and thoughts that there's autoantibodies involved, so an autoimmune condition. And then the inflammation caused by all of these things as well. But how that means you treat it is a whole other question.
Mm. What are the greatest needs of those who have long COVID? What have you learned from members of the Facebook group?
That the patient actually knows an awful lot. Collectively, we know an awful lot. We still know a lot more about the symptoms and their impact than the medical community. So the importance of listening to patients, not dismissing them as anxious. And if they are anxious, it's because they've probably had lack of treatment and been abandoned and ignored and sent from pillar to post. It's not because the anxiety is causing these symptoms. It certainly can be one of the symptoms triggered, but it's not the root cause of this. But the biggest need that we have is to find a treatment. I think we're really counting on researchers, and I know they're working their socks off, and we're so grateful for that, but it can never come quickly enough, I suppose.
Claire, you've expressed concern about multiple effects from long COVID on people's lives. What is your biggest fear when it comes to people experiencing post-COVID symptoms?
I think one of my biggest fears is that we'll be forgotten about at some point. you know, it in the next 1-2 years, you hope that the bigger stages of this pandemic are out of the way. But there'll be a certain proportion of people who are unable to resume their lives, unable to resume their work. And them being forgotten about is actually one of my biggest fears.
Claire Hasty is founder of the international support group Long COVID Support for people who experience COVID symptoms months after infection. She joined us from Birmingham, UK. Claire, thank you very much for explaining this to us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
As people start going back to museums this summer, there's one exhibit in Europe that's getting a lot of attention. The Netherlands National Museum of Art and History has its first ever major exhibition focused on the subject of slavery. It fits into a global movement that's reevaluating how various institutions tell history. As the world's Rupa Shenoy reports, there are a lot of debates about what history should be remembered.
The exhibit is at the Rijksmuseum. It's called simply Slavery. It doesn't attempt to explore all 250 years of Dutch colonial rule or to tell the stories of the more than 600,000 people enslaved by Dutch traders in the Americas. Instead, it focuses on specific individuals from the past. At the exhibit's opening, one of the curators, Velika Smulish, said that would allow visitors to empathize and ask what they would have done if they were alive back then.
Door ons te verdiepen in het verleden, door ons ertoe te verhouden.
By delving into the past, she said, and by relating to it, we understand better where we come from as a society and where we might be headed. The exhibit showcases some of the few objects enslaved people left behind and the tools they used on plantations, as well as paintings, archival documents, and audio recordings. Some poems and music have been recreated, like this one, voiced by students in Amsterdam. The exhibit tells the stories of 10 real people from history. You learn their names. Wally, Paulus, Tula, Dirk, Loke, Joao, Sapali, Upjen, Van Belhem, and Seropathy.
And this, I think, that is the big difference with what we are seeing now in the Netherlands. There are much more attempts to present a human face to enslaved people.
Ana Lucia Arauso is an historian at Howard University who contributed to the Rijksmuseum's slavery exhibit. She's also worked on similar efforts in the U.S., France, U.K., and Brazil. She says since the 1990s, many institutions have reassessed the way they tell this history. Not all have been successful.
They would emphasize too much this benevolent role of slavery, sometimes with a lot of emphasis on white abolitionists. In other places, too much emphasis on victimization, images of violence and physical punishment, repeating the trauma that was inflicted during the period of slavery.
Visitors have forced many institutions to improve, sometimes with instant feedback on social media. Yet Arauso says many exhibits about slavery still have a key flaw.
The biggest failure is that there are no connections very often between this historical past of slavery and present-day racism. They do not focus that much as they should on the connections between slavery and colonialism.
In other words, they don't focus on how slavery made colonial powers wealthy and how that wealth changed European countries in ways some people still benefit from today. The frustration about that among some in the European art and museum world spilled into public view late last year. Protesters went into the Royal Academy of Art in Copenhagen and spirited away a bust of Denmark's King Frederick V. Katrine Jerkin Holmfeld was an instructor there at the time.
What happened was that the bust was removed from its pedestal and it was submerged in the Copenhagen harbor as an attempt to sort of give it back to the network, the trade that had created it.
The Copenhagen harbor was a hub for the Danish slave trade, administered by the government of Frederick V, who also founded the Royal Academy of Art. The bust of him thrown into the harbor was plaster and just one of many copies. Jerkin Holmfeld came forward and took credit for the act, saying she wanted to start a dialogue about how colonialism and slavery funded a new era in Danish art and culture. There was a lot of blowback. She lost her job.
When it comes to addressing issues of colonialism and how that still has an impact on the institution. I think there's very little ability to deal with this certain form of critique in Denmark at the moment.
In the neighboring Netherlands, the Rijksmuseum's new slavery exhibit does incorporate a direct look at how the country profited from the slave trade and colonialism. And at the opening, curator Velike Smulisch tried to walk a fine line.
De koloniale slavernij ligt immers achter ons. De samenleving van nu.
Colonial slavery is behind us, Smulisch said, and today's society no longer bears responsibility for it. Clearly, a lot of people would take issue with that. But then she went on to say, what we can do now, together, is decide how to deal with that past. For the world, I'm Rupa Shenoy.
The fragile peace in the Middle East is fraying. Just weeks after agreeing to a ceasefire, Israel and Hamas are fighting again. Hamas launched incendiary balloons that sparked 20 fires in southern Israel. Hamas said the balloons were a response to Israeli nationalists marching in Palestinian neighborhoods in East Jerusalem. Then, in response to those balloons, Israel's new government ordered a military attack targeting compounds belonging to Hamas in Gaza. For more on these developments, we turn to Noga Tarnopolsky. She's a writer and reporter covering the Mideast and joins us from Jerusalem. Noga, can you start us off with more details on this latest round of violence between Hamas and Israel? How intense has it been?
Well, it's hard to answer that question. I think it's important to mention, on the one hand, that there have not been any casualties, either in Jerusalem or in Gaza or on the Gaza border. So I wouldn't want to make this sound like renewed war. It's not. On the other hand, it's a kind of tit for tat, which the ceasefire between Hamas and Israel did not resolve. What happened yesterday was a march of ultranationalists that had been interrupted on May 10th when Hamas sent rockets towards Jerusalem.
From where we sit, it seems this parade is provocative. Can you tell us more about it and why it was allowed to happen?
The parade is extremely provocative, and yesterday's parade was extremely ugly. It included groups of young people. They were even spitting on journalists. They were shrieking death to Arabs. This is a group of what I would call extremist racial supremacists. There are not a lot of them, but they exist, and they have the right to free expression, and that's why the march was allowed to go on. But it's still very much a provocation, and Hamas took that provocation and sent what the media calls, we're calling these incendiary balloons, but I just want to make it clear to people, we're talking about flying Molotov cocktails.
Mm. I was going to ask you about those incendiary balloons. We've heard about them before. So, I mean, what are they, and are they effective?
Well, I guess I'd have to say yes. But what it is basically these are Molotov cocktails fitted to helium balloons that are sent across the border into Israel. The Israeli south is heavily agricultural. So in the fires that were started yesterday, there were entire acres, fields of wheat that were burned down, other agricultural fields, people's homes burned. I always have the concern when we describe these as incendiary balloons that it sounds insignificant. And on military terms, it is, but it's pretty significant when you live there. And the very high-tech Israeli army has not found any solutions.
Right. And Prime Minister Bennett is into day three of his job. His government, of course, as you said, is the one that called in these strikes on compounds in Gaza. So it seems strategy towards Gaza has not changed that much. That said, he's, again, into day three of his job. What do these moves toward Gaza tell us in these early days of his government?
It's hard for me to answer you because while the Israeli government did order airstrikes, and I'm sure that they ordered them both for domestic reasons to show Israelis that they're not letting the entire south of the country burn without a response, and also as a response to Hamas to say, you know, don't think we're a joke, this new government. The airstrikes also did not cause any physical harm. Hitting Hamas, you know, let's say deposit type buildings or even arms depots, it's a fairly mild response to something that has caused life in the south of Israel to become almost unlivable for many people. And I don't think we should overdo the importance of these initial days. I think the new incoming prime minister is trying to get through his first few days or even his first week in a kind of Biden-esque fashion. He's almost not speaking in public. He's allowing the government's actions to speak for him.
With his very mixed bloc and Naftali Bennett's own kind of position, it sounds like he's going to distance himself from Netanyahu despite how close they've been. What could that mean for Palestinians?
I'm afraid that for Palestinians, things are going to just be on ice for a little while. So the government is going to have a lot of domestic issues on its hands initially. And the Biden administration has gone out of its way to show, I would say, a big welcome to this Israeli government. I think the Biden administration is breathing a sigh of relief not to have to deal with Benjamin Netanyahu anymore. And however strong American interests are, to bring Israel and the Palestinian Authority back to the negotiating table or even to advance about towards an Iran deal, I think that Washington's going to be very careful not to do anything which could destabilize the fragile Israeli coalition.
Writer and reporter Noga Tarnopolsky with the latest on a flare-up of violence between Israelis and Palestinians. She joined us from Jerusalem. Noga, thank you very much.
Thank you.
For five centuries, the Quechua-Chaca Bridge has been connecting communities on both sides of the Apur-Imak River. This is in Peru, in the region of Cusco. Now, this bridge will surprise you. It's made entirely of string, specifically a kind of twine made from local grasses, woven together into thick, strong cables by skilled local artisans. Every June, these artisans come together to cut down the old bridge and weave a new one. Yep, they weave a new bridge each year. That's followed by a community-wide celebration. Because of the pandemic, that did not happen last year, and this legendary bridge fell into disrepair. This year, though, a new twist in the story, if you will. The weavers have returned. The bridge is being rebuilt or reweaved. This technique goes back centuries when these bridges were an integral part of connecting the Inca Empire. The bridge's architect, Victoriano Arizpana, spoke to Smithsonian about how these skills are passed down through generations. He says he started learning this work when he was just 12 from his father, and now he loves the bridge like a son. Cusco Regional Governor Jean-Paul Benavente said the bridge's repair this year is a sign that his region may be coming out of the pandemic little by little. Peru's been one of the world's worst-hit countries by COVID. The governor also said that the bridge doesn't just connect villages, but also connects traditions and culture. Connecting cultures, it's something we can appreciate here at The World. It's also a good note to close on today. We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. Thank you for listening. Hope to have you back here with us tomorrow. From PR.